From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how Wayne State University did what no other could, keeping its infection rates down.
There's no question that very, very heavy burden of disease early on made people much more careful, much more vigilant.
Also, Detroit prioritizes people with disabilities for vaccination. Next stop, the whole state.
We knew that in the moments when really important decisions were being made quickly, in response to the pandemic, that we'd probably be forgotten. And unfortunately, to a large degree, that's exactly what happened.
And restaurants welcome more indoor diners amid extant economic threats to their survival.
And we are getting more and more people who've been vaccinated, and so they're excited to go out.
Those stories and more coming up on today's episode of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we touch base with one homegrown restaurant chain deciding what to do about reopening at one quarter capacity.
I know some who made a decision relatively early on just to close for a year or two and come back.
That's coming up later in the hour. But first, college campuses pose such particular problems in containing and treating COVID-19. In Washtenaw County alone, students at the University of Michigan make up about two-thirds of all COVID infections in the county. One of the state's major universities appears to have gotten through the pandemic with relatively minor issues in the way of infections and infection rates. That's Wayne State University in Detroit. A recent New York Times article comparing college campus infections showed Wayne State with fewer than 500 total COVID cases and just 60 cases so far this year. By comparison, U of M had closer to 5,000 total, 1,500 of them since January. So what is Wayne State doing differently? Here to talk about his university's approach is President M. Roy Wilson. President Wilson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
We've watched so many institutions across the state struggling to thread the needle of providing the college experience that students are coming for while containing the spread of this novel virus. How has it landed with you that Wayne State has not faced major containment issues?
I think the main thing is just the behavior of our students. We're not a residential campus that has a lot of week life, for example. So, you know, our students are just different than some students, like, for example, at Michigan State and University of Michigan, where week life is a very big part of the student experience. It's a very, very small part of our student experience. And so I think it's mainly the behavior of our students. I think the other part also is that, you know, we do have a public health committee that we started at the beginning of the pandemic that's made up of experts from a number of different hospitals that we're affiliated with, DMC, Henry Ford, nurses, epidemiologists, and they get together on a weekly basis and monitor the data coming from the state, from the city, our own data, and advisors. And so they've been doing a good job, I think, and has been very conservative in terms of their approach.
I do wonder if Detroit's very dire situation in the early weeks of the pandemic didn't have some kind of role in forming this, even for students who do not live in Detroit, who might be commuting in from surrounding communities or international students, if the very high contagion rate and death rate in those early days sobered a lot of people into taking the precautions very seriously. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I absolutely think that's true. Now, if you live in Detroit, if you lived in Detroit in, let's say, February, March into April, there's no way that you could not know someone who had succumbed to COVID-19. I mean, everyone knew at least one person, and most of us knew multiple people who did not do well. And so there's no question that very, very heavy burden of disease early on made people much more careful, much more vigilant, had them more compliant with face masks and other public health measures than might have been the case in some other areas of the state where the early impact was not nearly as great.
What has learning looked like for students at Wayne State over the past year?
Well, you know, like other universities, we had to go predominantly remote. And it's a different experience. Now, I will tell you that the students, many students have acclimated very nicely to it. They thrived. But there are some students who are going to have problems. You know, there are students who don't have the same kind of resources to be able to have an environment at home conducive to being on a computer. There are students who, just the way they learn, they need that interaction with people. So for a variety of reasons, there's going to be a subset of students where remote learning just isn't going to work out very well for them. And so we've certainly seen that, and we've tried to do everything we can to mitigate the negative effects of that. But for the most part, I think students have adjusted very well. We try to put on as many classes face-to-face as we can for those classes that where it's just very difficult to do it totally remotely. And I'm talking about some of the clinics, laboratory classes, things like dance. You know, there are certain classes where it's just a much better experience to do it face-to-face. And so we've tried to, as much as possible, allow those to continue to be face-to-face. But there's no question that overall experience has been greatly impacted this year for all students.
Right. There's no question that all institutions are also dealing with certain financial constraints. I mean, you can't double your space to accommodate physical distancing. You can't necessarily, you know, bulk up your teaching staff at a time like this to provide extra academic help. Could you tell us a little bit more about the mitigation efforts that Wayne State has gone through to try to help people who are maybe struggling academically through this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly you've hit on some of the issues. For universities, you know, we are not going to be able to have large classes like we used to. Some of the classes that are like the freshman classes for biology and classes like that, you know, it's sometimes there are 200, 250 students to a large classroom. Well, certainly we're not going to be able to do that. And so we've got to be able to spread people out. We started what's called a restart committee. Very early on in the, February, March timeframe, and we've been meeting weekly. And that committee has people like the person in charge of facilities, the person in charge of grounds, person in charge of housing. And so we meet on a weekly basis to discuss different issues. A lot of issues related to facilities that we had to mitigate. The error controlling systems, you know, all that has been changed out for the most part. Being able to have a system where we have frequent cleanings than we used to have. Having bacterial resistant door handles, you know, all kinds of things like that, which is new for us and does cost a fair amount of funds. But our model all along has been safety first. So all of our decisions are going to be based on what's the most safest thing for our students and our faculty and staff, and other considerations last. So we really haven't thought about the financial impact of many of the things that we've done. If it was the right thing to do for safety reasons, we've done it. And we'll face the financial consequences of that, you know, later. But we think that it's really important to make sure that safety is our first consideration in whatever decisions we make.
On the subject of finances, I've got to believe that enrollment has changed during this time. Could you tell us a little bit about what Wayne State's experience has been with that?
Well, this might surprise you, but our fall 2020 enrollment, which was, you know, right at the height of the epidemic or the pandemic, we had the largest freshman class in the history of the university. So we had a large class come in. In our winter semester, we had a slight fall off from last year as more students, for whatever reason, didn't come back. But even then, that was only about a 2% decline from last year. And last year was also a very large class. We are concerned about this coming fall because, as you've already, you know, identified, I mean, it's a different learning experience. Many of our students, particularly from Detroit, you know, just won't have had the face-to-face interactions that most students that go to college have had in their senior year of high school in preparation for college. Not having had that experience is going to be difficult for many students. And so our enrollments thus far for fall is lower than what I would like it to be. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we get a lot of our students from Detroit, and Detroit and minorities have been disproportionately impacted by the remote learning. And so we're going to have to work hard between now and fall to make sure that our enrollment is what will be typical for fall enrollment for us.
Dr. Wilson, you alluded to just the ways Detroit has changed during this time. We know some businesses have folded up. There's been decreased foot traffic from commuters working in the city. Could you say something about just how the city looks and feels to you right now, and what you think the prospects are going forward?
Well, you know, the city doesn't look or feel normal at all. As you mentioned, I mean, there's a lot of businesses that are boarded up, but it's a sacrifice that has to be made. I disagree with, you know, some of the decisions being made around the country in terms of trying to get back to complete normality at this point in time. I think it's the wrong thing to do. I think that Detroit, as has most of Michigan, been very responsible in their responses and have prioritized safety over economics. You know, obviously there's economic cost to that, and that can't be done forever. But I think there's a little bit more sacrifice that's necessary in order to have a brighter future. I think Detroit is on the right path. It's done a very good job. The percent positivity in the city right now is lower than that of the rest of Michigan. Our campus is extremely low. Our percent positivity is in the 0.2% range, something like that. So it's extremely low. And I feel optimistic with the new vaccines coming out and the supply getting more plentiful. I feel very optimistic that Detroit, as well as most of Michigan, will do fine.
M. Roy Wilson is the president of Wayne State University. Dr. Wilson, thank you.
Thank you very much.
In other stories we're following, Detroit has made the decision to begin vaccinating people with disabilities.
People with intellectual and developmental disabilities are 3 times more likely to die from COVID than other people.
We'll talk next with one activist who helped make it happen. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What to say about the pandemic? All the fear, the inconveniences, the isolation, the disruption of our routines. Now, say all the things that everyone is grappling with, and say them twice for those among us living with disabilities. Detroit recently announced that it's placed people with disabilities in a priority group, and they can now schedule their vaccine appointments. Dessa Cosma is the executive director of Detroit Disability Power, and she joins us now. Hi, Dessa. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi. Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
There's such a range of ways that COVID might be affecting people's lives in this moment. Could you talk a little bit about what you've seen happening with your community during the pandemic?
Absolutely. So since the beginning of the pandemic, since the moment that things shut down in Michigan and people across the country were realizing that this was happening in the United States, the disability community was on high alert. Intuitively, we knew that we would be harder hit than others. We knew that we were likely to be left out of the emergency response because we fall through the cracks on a good day. You know, when there's not a global pandemic and an economic recession, people with disabilities are not doing well as a group because of structural inequities, because of ableism, which is the systemic oppression of people with disabilities. We tend to be neglected. We tend to not be at the table when decisions are being made that impact us. And we knew that in the moments when really important decisions were being made quickly, in response to the pandemic, that we'd probably be forgotten. And unfortunately, to a large degree, that's exactly what happened. There was another thing that was really concerning at the beginning of the pandemic, which was the dominant narrative in the media and from our elected officials was aimed to calm everyone down. The narrative was, okay, guys, you know, calm down. It's just the sick people. It's just the old people that are going to die. Like, everyone calm down. And, you know, for those of us who are the sick and old people, makes us feel like we're expendable. And that didn't need to be the case. And all of us started raising the alarm immediately, trying to get our elected officials to do things so that we could access the information about staying safe, make sure that data was collected on people with disabilities who got COVID so that we could design correct interventions, making sure that hospitals weren't discriminating against us when they didn't have enough hospital beds or ventilators. And here we are now, 11 months later, trying to make sure we have access to the vaccine. And again, we're somehow at the back of the line.
Could you, I know that you were part of the campaign to get the city of Detroit to expand its vaccine eligibility. Will you tell us when and how that got started?
Sure. So, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic, Detroit Disability Power and other disability rights and justice organizations in Michigan and across the country have been doing a lot of organizing. And we have gotten some wins, and we've also largely been ignored. And so as the new year started and vaccinations started becoming available and we started being able to see the end of the tunnel for this pandemic, we also realized when we looked at the state's vaccine distribution plan that people with disabilities were almost completely absent from that plan. And at the same time, research started coming out from around the country about the disparate impact of COVID on people with disabilities. And the data wasn't disturbing in a small way. The data was highly disturbing. People with intellectual and developmental disabilities are 3 times more likely to die from COVID than other people. People with schizophrenia are 3 times more likely to die from COVID. People with Down syndrome are 10 times more likely to die from COVID. These are really unacceptable disparities. These are not inevitabilities. It didn't have to be this way. And there's still time to rectify that to some degree through prioritizing vaccines for these groups, but there has to be the political will to do it. So we started organizing. I mean, that's what we do. We're a social justice organization. We started organizing our community and our allies to put pressure on the mayor and on the governor and MDHHS to say, hey, enough is enough. We've been ignored. The data shows what the impact of that neglect is, and you have to do something about this. And so we sent 400 letters in 10 days to the mayor's office, countless phone calls to the mayor's office, and he looked at the data and he saw the reality, which is that there's a disparity that's unacceptable, and he made the right choice by prioritizing vaccines for people 18 and older with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
It's not hard to understand why COVID poses such a threat to someone with, I don't know, like a serious CP condition or a severe developmental disability. Can you unpack why it's also a struggle for folks with, say, vision impairments or autism or schizophrenia?
So I think people do kind of intuitively understand that some bodies are more susceptible to illness and disease because of weaknesses in the immune system. And so, as you said, that's one factor. But just the way that disparities exist for other marginalized groups, right, due to higher rates of poverty, due to lack of information in appropriate modes, due to neglect in decision-making rooms, all of those also apply to communities of people with disabilities, right? So we had to fight initially to make sure that briefings about COVID were done in American Sign Language. We're still having to fight to make sure that websites that allow people to sign up for vaccines are usable by a screen reader so blind and visually impaired people can sign up. These structural issues add up in really significant ways. So someone like me, who's a wheelchair user, my body itself is not more susceptible to COVID, but the circumstances of being disabled in this society make me more susceptible. I have to touch more things. I can't socially distance from people in the same way. Many people in our community have personal care attendants who help them bathe and use the restroom and eat. All of these factors add up to make people more susceptible. And so it's really important to remember that we know that there's a disparity in communities of color, not because people of color's bodies are weaker to COVID, but because of the social factors. Those social factors also apply to people with disabilities, and they're doubly impactful to people of color with disabilities.
Dessa, what kind of conversations have you had with the state about opening up the line, the vaccination line, to people with disabilities all across Michigan?
We have sent almost 900 letters in the last 3 weeks to the governor's office and MDHHS. These are constituents from around mostly southeastern Michigan who are raising their voices to say, hey, pay attention to us. We have had multiple appearances in local media, on TV, radio, and in print. And we're not getting much of a response from the state. We know that there's a lack of data collected. There's a lack of transparency about the data that has been collected. We know the risk is there. The data from other places shows a tremendous disparity. And we're just not getting enough action from the state.
We got a note. We got a note from a listener a little while ago, and she has a son who's living with autism. She was obviously very frightened for him contracting COVID because of what his hospital experience would be like. But she was also just deeply worried that people who work with him, caregivers, were prioritized while he was not. What we hear from the state that's a matter of practicality. But what does it say about the value that we place on the lives of people with disabilities?
Well, I can't speak for how anybody at the state feels, but what I can say is that as a disabled person, it makes me feel unvalued. It scares me that my life is considered less important than someone else's. I know what discrimination feels like. I deal with it every time I leave my house, which, lately isn't much. But for all of my 38 years, I have known what discrimination feels like. And it can feel frustrating. It can feel infuriating. But it also feels scary. It feels, and it feels really hurtful to know that people like me, people that I love, who are disabled, are not considered worth saving in this moment. That feels deeply immoral. It also feels like bad public policy. All of the evidence points to a hugely disparate impact, and yet we're not seeing action.
Yeah. What have you heard about the hospital experience for people who have contracted the disease?
It varies based on the person and based on the circumstance, right? So, one of the things about disability is that it's very diverse. There's a million different diagnoses. And on top of that, people have other identities that impact the way that people treat them and their access to resources. So there's going to be a lot of different experiences, and they're going to be somewhat idiosyncratic, but they're also across the board. If you talk to people with disabilities, there's a lot of negative, largely negative experiences in hospitals and medical establishments, even pre-COVID. So going in alone to a hospital because you can't have somebody come with you, if you're a person who really relies on the stability of a caregiver or a parent who helps you with daily tasks, is terrifying. Going in knowing that a person who works there may not see your life as valuable as the patient in the room next door means that you may not get care if there's not enough to go around. That's terrifying. I haven't heard any good stories, I'll tell you that. There's a lot of different ways that this is very scary to people in our community.
Can we talk for a minute about how the vaccination rollout is going for the folks that you advocate for? Are people able to get appointments to get their shots?
So I used myself as a test case for this immediately when Mayor Duggan made the announcement. And I was able to call and make an appointment without any problem. The first question that I was asked is, are you 65? Which I am not. And What I quickly followed up my no response with was, but I am a person with a developmental disability. And she said, okay, well, let's get you scheduled. And within a few days, I was at TCF. I drove myself there. I had a very smooth experience. I showed them a note from my doctor stating that I had a developmental disability. And I got my shot, and I was out of there within 45 minutes. That is the way it should go. Yeah. But I've also heard reports of people calling and the person on the phone saying that they weren't eligible because they weren't 65. And so there's definitely some room for some training on the call center end. So we're trying to work with the city to make sure that, those glitches are getting fixed.
What about the accessibility of places where people are going? There is the TCF Center, but I know there are other churches and places that people might be asked to go to get their vaccination.
Sure. So I don't know much about the churches. I do know that having lived in Detroit for 15 years, a lot of the churches here are old and not very accessible. I'm not sure, though, how or where they're doing them on the church grounds. So like at TCF, you don't even get out of your car. So if you can get a ride or if you can drive, it is accessible. Of course, a lot of people in our community can't do that. And so the city is offering wheelchair accessible rides if you ask for one, which is amazing. In terms of other types of access, I think we need to investigate further, right? So can a person who is deaf get through to the call center to make an appointment? I think we need to figure out how to best do that. And there are other, you know, kind of logistical barriers that always pop up for people with disabilities in these situations, but that we can mitigate for.
We heard an argument earlier this week that primary care doctors should be able to vaccinate, that they should be among the institutions that the state should send doses to. What do you think of that idea?
Well, to be honest, I haven't thought about it much, so I'm not totally sure. But it does seem to me that having more people able to administer vaccines, particularly when people with disabilities may have a relationship with a doctor already, that might make them feel more comfortable and it might be more accessible to them. That sounds like a good thing. I do think it's really important that we start having a strategy not only for going into neighborhoods to vaccinate people so that it's easier for people to find the mobile unit than it is to get down to TCF or something like that, but also to go into people's homes. There are a lot of disabled people who cannot leave their house and have caregivers coming and going, so they are at risk of getting COVID, and they need to be able to get a vaccine too. So we got to put that on the list of things to get done here in Detroit and across the state.
There have been many, many conversations during this past year about how things should be different after the pandemic. Are there fault lines that the epidemic has highlighted in Michigan's relationship with folks with disabilities?
Absolutely. The lack of access to decision-making tables in meaningful ways is huge. The lack of prioritization for our community, that's become even more evident. It seems very obvious to us at Detroit Disability Power and other disability organizations that have been working on these things the last 11 months, that there's just not a competency at most government levels and in most departments about disability and what our day-to-day lives are like. And without that competency, decisions are going to be made that not only exclude us, but actually harm us. And so we have a lot of learning to do as a larger Michigan community. The good news is that people with disabilities can really help non-disabled people get it if those people are willing to listen. We have a lot to teach that's not just beneficial for us as disabled people, but actually beneficial for entire communities, because there's a lot of disabled people. You know, in Detroit alone, there's 126,000 disabled people. All of us have families or friends or caregivers who are impacted by our lives and the ways that we can or cannot access our communities. And so solving problems for people with disabilities actually is a really good move for everyone.
Dessa Cosma is the executive director of Detroit Disability Power. Dessa, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Of all the things COVID-19 has upended, the most personal one might be our relationships with each other. We want to know, how have your relations with your friends, with your family, with total strangers changed during the pandemic? Maybe you're feeling sick of your pod right now, or finding joy in having more time with your family. Maybe you're trying to navigate socially distanced dating. Whatever your experience, we'd love to hear about it. Send us your stories of pod life by leaving us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. One more time, that's 734-764-7840. Or email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. And then tune in next week for a deep dive on pandemic relationships and advice on how to keep each other close in tough times. Again, the email address is stateside@michiganradio.org. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Do you ever wish you could keep closer tabs on what's going on in your local government? Michigan Radio has been busy with a new project that we can finally tell you about today, a project that's going to help you do that. It's called Minutes, and our point man on the project is Michigan Radio reporter Dustin Dwyer, and he's here to tell all. Hey, Dustin.
Hey, April.
So Minutes came out of the grain of an idea about public meetings. Do you want to explain sort of how the concept got rolling?
Yeah, well, it starts as sort of a problem that we had as a newsroom, and certainly a problem I had as a reporter for Michigan Radio. We cover the whole state. It's a big state. And our newsroom, it's growing, but it's not an enormous newsroom. It's not a huge newsroom. So we have a few people trying to keep track of a lot of meetings. And I thought there might be a way to keep better track of these meetings and, in fact, sort of be able to track more meetings than we can do now if we can create transcripts of the meetings and then just skim through the transcripts or search the transcripts to compare things happening in different cities. So that's where the idea started. It was just, you know, an idea that I had. We got a little bit of help and funding from the Google News Initiative, and then we handed it off to a person on our staff named Brad Gowland, and I was like, Brad, this is the idea. Can we do this? And Brad figured out a way to do it. So the way it works now is that if a city posts, say, a city council meeting online, Brad has created this program that allows us to download the audio from that. That audio is then sent to a podcast feed, which you can now subscribe to. And it also creates a transcript, an automated transcript that then drops into a database that our reporters can access to search for stories.
Wait a minute. You just blew my mind with the podcast aspect. Are you telling me I can podcast my local city council, school board, and county board of commissioners meetings?
You can podcast your city council meetings for 42 cities in Michigan right now. And the hope is that we can expand that list, that this will just be the start. But as of today, as of right now, you can go to MichiganRadio.org. You can click on Minutes and you'll see a list of cities. There are 42 cities. If you live in one of those cities or you're just interested in their city council meetings, you can click subscribe. You will listen to those city council meetings as they come in as podcasts. And hopefully if this is useful for people and we get to continue it, soon you'll be able to listen to school board meetings or planning commission meetings or county commission meetings, any types of meetings. The goal is to make them more accessible, just easier to tune into.
So I just have to say, as a lifelong dork, I am actually looking forward to being able to go over things in podcast form as I listen to them as I'm washing dishes or something. But I imagine the real big get here is the fact that these transcripts are now available, right?
Right. The transcripts we're not publishing the transcripts publicly at this point. And the reason is because if you've ever used, it's done through a speech to text program. And if you've ever used one of those programs, you know that it's not perfectly accurate. So you get enough of a result to sort of get the gist of what's going on. And it's pretty good, but it's not good enough that we would publish them online and say, this is the official transcript for this public government meetings. But what it does allow us to do is it's good enough for our reporters reporters to search for it. So what we have now sort of on our end for our newsroom is that these transcripts are dumped into a database. And if our reporter is working on a story about, say, vaccines or about funding for police departments, our reporters can go in and see where those things have been mentioned at these city council meetings going back a few months and see different communities where it's being talked about. So the idea is it's a tool for our reporters to deepen our reporting and to know more about what's happening in these meetings. But ultimately, one day, I do hope that we can use a technique like this to make the content of a public meeting totally searchable, so that you could just go to a search engine or a smart speaker and say, hey, what happened at this city council meeting? And you'd get, you know, a result.
About those transcriptions, I've seen some real howlers as I've used some that are available for news reporters. I can only imagine what happens when you turn these loose on 42 different public meetings.
Well, that's the thing. And that's why we are not publishing these transcripts, on our website to just anyone, because it would be great. I would love to make it possible for our audience to just be able to search these meetings. But the reality is that, you know, we're using a program here that's not perfect. So I wouldn't want to create the impression that these transcripts that our reporters are using are like a documented, you know, official recording of what happens at the meetings. And just as an example, you know, sometimes the program has trouble transcribing certain words. Like, we've been searching for the word vaccine a lot. We want to know when city council governments are talking about vaccines. Well, in the transcripts, as you say, I've seen vaccine translated by this program as Maxine, like the name Maxine. I've seen it translated as backscene, like pat on the back and movie scene. And I've also seen it translated once as sex scene. So I certainly, that's a translation that, that's not something we would want to publish. It's not accurate. It wouldn't help inform people. But it's good enough that for our reporters on the back end, we can do a keyword search. Like, I can search vaccine and get a general idea that people are talking about vaccines, or I can search for Maxine and get a general idea. And then we can use that to do stories.
So as a reporter, I can think of 10,000 ways that this would make life better. Let's talk about the benefits for anybody who wants to try it. First of all, what kind of tech would somebody need to log on and try Minutes?
Well, first, the public part of Minutes is really just the podcast at this point. So all you need is, if you already subscribe to podcast, search for your city in wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify or Apple, that type of thing. Or you can go to michiganradio.org and the links are right there for you. You can look at if you click on Minutes, you can see which cities are covered. So for now, really the experience for you is just podcasts. As it builds out, what we're hoping is that our reporters will be able to do more stories. And certainly you can contact us. We have, you can reach us by email, minutes@michiganradio.org. If you have a question and you're like, hey, I'm wondering if other city councils are talking about this, has anyone brought this up? I could type in a quick search and let you know and maybe do a story about it. Down the road, what I hope is that what we have available now is really just a prototype for something that we could build out in the future that would really make it much more accessible for you to search for things in city council meetings. But that's the future. Today, it's just podcasts.
Dustin, most jurisdictions do offer some kind of digital access to their meetings right now, or it's safe to say that a lot more started doing it during the pandemic so people could keep up on the public's business. What do you see as the benefit of having a bunch of different jurisdictions in this one system?
The benefit for our reporters is that we can start to connect things that we didn't know. We can start to connect threads that we didn't know were there. So I live in Grand Rapids. I as a reporter, I keep fairly close tabs on what's happening at Grand Rapids City Commission meetings. But I don't always know, like, if Grand Rapids City Commission is talking about something, I don't know if other commissions are talking about this. So this happened to me a couple of weeks ago, and I used our tool to discover this. The Grand Rapids City Commission was talking about income tax and how that would affect the city's budget in the coming year. And I thought, there's other cities in Michigan that collect income tax. Is this going to be a problem for other cities? And I searched our database, the database that's now available to our reporters, and I found other cities where they were talking about the same problem. So the idea is that you may be able to know a lot about your own city. You may follow that city, but you won't necessarily know how it relates to other cities in Michigan and what they're doing. And the hope with something like this is it allows our reporters to draw those connections and get you more information.
So I have to ask, how does it feel to launch 42 podcasts all in the same day?
It's exciting. It's a little stressful. I say that these podcasts are brought to you by Michigan Radio, but co-produced by Michigan's Open Meetings Act, because all of this is really available because of Michigan's Open Meetings Act that allows this information to be public. And, you know, cities could have done this themselves. They could have created their own podcast feed, but most cities haven't done this yet. So we're doing it, and I'm excited that we're doing it.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. Dustin, thank you so much. This is a super cool project.
Thanks, April.
This week, Governor Whitmer announced that restaurants in Michigan can increase their indoor dining from 25% capacity to 50%. The increased traffic will likely be very welcome news to restaurants that have been able to survive the pandemic. This is still not a return to business as usual, as we understood it in 2019. This got us thinking about something that Ari Weinzweig, the co-owner of Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, was talking to us about last fall. That this, all of this, is not really a long-term sustainable business model for restaurants. And he joins us now. Ari, welcome back to Stateside.
I'm honored to be here on this warm, sunny Michigan winter day.
So how does the news of half capacity for indoor land with you and everybody else in the Zingerman's family?
It lands well. I mean, we're just trying to follow the governor and the state health department's lead. And we've worked really hard to be diligent. And when they've asked us to go down, we go down. When they suggest we go up, we go up. So they're working hard on their end, I know, and everybody is at the national level too. And we're just trying to follow along and do the best we can to keep in business, keep our staff safe, and keep our guests safe.
We know that you spend time on the floor of Zingerman's Roadhouse refilling waters and talking to customers. What have they been saying about returning to dining indoors rather than ordering takeout?
They're happy. Well, I think, you know, to state the obvious, they are self-selecting. So the people who don't want to eat indoors are not there to tell me how they feel about eating indoors.
Right.
But I will say without question, there, when we reopened the dining room, I'm trying to think it's now a month, a lot of really just happy people to be back. And we are getting more and more people who've been vaccinated. And so they're excited to go out.
I wonder about that every time I pick up takeout and I see people sitting down. Some of those people must be vaccinated, right? Yeah.
There's definitely more and more of them, and there will be more going forward, clearly.
Yeah. Will half-capacity dining make the numbers work for Zingerman's on the financial side?
It would not make the numbers work. But I don't think this is... It doesn't seem like this is in perpetuity. So there was hopeful news last night, not just from the governor, but from President Biden around earlier delivery of hundreds of millions of vaccine dosages. So that also was encouraging. So it's really about getting through. There's a $25 billion bill for independent restaurants in the Biden administration's economic package. This is coming. We talked when you and I talked earlier in the fall about the Independent Restaurant Coalition. So this work has manifested, continued to push forward, and it's hopefully will pass the Senate next week. And if that happens, it doesn't mean we'll get it, but it does mean independent restaurants around the country will have access to additional federal support to try to help bridge that gap between where people are at right now, whether it's 50%, 25% or whatever, back to when things seem to be headed towards reopening. So thankfully, again, Debbie Dingell, Senator Peters and Stabenow have been all co-sponsoring that bill, which is great.
Yeah. Zingerman's is known for paying servers and staff well. Were you able to continue to make that a priority and to keep staffing up during the last 14 months or so?
Well, we're trying. I mean, I never feel like we're paying enough. I mean, I always want to pay people more. It's just trying to figure out how to pay the bills and pay people more at the same time and walking that line. But I would love to raise everybody's pay quickly. if we had the money. But I mean, no one. Well, let me think. In the restaurant setting, people's pay has not gone down. I'm just thinking it through, but I think that's across the board.
You know, it's always scary to hear a popular and well-known business say that outdoor dining, reduced indoor capacity, and curbside pickup might not be enough for some businesses. Do you have many peers or friends who have not been able to see the year through?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, I know many who have not. I know some who made a decision relatively early on just to close for a year or two and come back. We made a conscious choice not to do that just because we feel like we have an important role in the community as a source of positive emotional experiences as well as culinary. And we feel an obligation, which I think is a good one, to try to keep positive jobs available to people and just keep some continuity and consistency and connection in the community through this whole thing. So I feel good about our decision to do that, but I definitely know people who decided it's not worth the aggravation. I can lose the same amount of money by just closing and staying home and not taking on all this extra work. I know other ones who would like to have stayed open, but they don't have the money. The PPP loans have helped many, but many weren't eligible or able to use PPP loans because of the way it was structured. It was helpful for some, but there were definitely restaurants I know where they weren't open at all or barely open, and they weren't able to use the money in a way that would make it viable, which is why this additional restaurant bill is structured much differently and would be much more helpful across the industry.
When you think about those chefs and owners and staff who have been stepping away, there's something that sometimes happens during recessions when people go idle. People just might leave their businesses. I know that's happened in some of the trades over the course of the Great Recession. Do you see people leaving the food and service industries altogether, or do you think that there will be a full return?
You know, I think that all of us, when there's my experience is when one piece of our community, whatever that is, changes, there inevitably are others in the community who have been thinking about leaning in that direction. And so it helps push people, not in a bad way, but pushes them a little bit more towards what they were already inclined to do. So I love what I do. I feel very committed to the community. So yeah, it's hard, but this is what we're here to do. We're here to provide continuity and meaningful work and support our suppliers and try to feed great meals. And so is it easier when there's not a pandemic? Absolutely. But that work doesn't change. On the other hand, in all walks of life, people, for whatever reasons, are less than satisfied or the unfulfilled or feel less of a sense of vocation than I would say I feel. And so if that's the case, and you were already tired of it, you know, this gives one more sense of why you might want to opt out. I had a new pamphlet came out at the end of January called Working Through Hard Times, Life and Leadership Learnings from 2020. Just my own reflections and a way for me to process, in a sense, the last year and the learnings and the grieving that goes with the changes that have happened. But I realized I could have interpreted the title. It's not just working through hard times. It's working, through hard times, because I realized there's a sense of continuity and connection that I've been able to keep. And hopefully most of our staff, other than the times that we've had to furlough people, because we are working and we are seeing each other and we are connected. And I know there's a lot of people who've been really cut off from their communities for a year now, you know, without a lot of interactivity. So I feel fortunate that keeping that continuity has certainly helped my spirit.
Ari Weinswig is the co-owner of Zingerman's in Ann Arbor. Ari, thank you for checking in with us. We appreciate the update.
Well, thank you for all you do, and really thanks. I feel fortunate to be in such a great community, and I look forward to positive things to come.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for being with us. See you tomorrow.